You're listening to the Surgeons of Horror podcast.
John Carpenter.
The early years. Someone's watching me.
Welcome to the second season of the Surgeons of Horror podcast. Its purpose is to look into the horror films, dissecting them one screen legend at a time. Our second horror legend and focus for this current season is director, writer, producer and composer John Carpenter. And we'll be looking back at his career and the impact he had on the horror film genre. In order to successfully do this, we need a team of horror aficionados who will form the surgical team each episode. First up is yours truly, Paul Farrell, and I'm the lead surgeon and host for this series. I'm a self-confessed horror freak and I grew up drawn to the dark work of the silver screen, pretty much throwing myself into the arena, absorbing as much of the genre with relish and glee. Joining me each episode at the operating theatre is a select team of horror aficionados who are hand-selected to perform the surgical task of dissecting each movie. On this particular movie, I have alongside me Chief Surgical Technician Ben Skinner.
Buongiorno.
Oh, I'm throwing a bit of European flavour into the mix. And he's literally on hand to kind of get into the guts of the subject. That's the team for this one. We're a bit smaller, mainly because the movie in question that we're talking about, it would be the third movie that John Carpenter would do, and it's a TV movie.
And it's small scale.
It's small scale.
So we're trimmed.
We're keeping it compact. The movie in question is called Someone's Watching Me. It's a movie that even Carpenter has on his resume that a lot of people aren't aware of.
I have no idea.
It's integral though, because I mean, we'll see if you agree as we talk through the movie itself. There's a lot of this that he tools up ready for Halloween. So there's a lot of voyeuristic kind of stuff going on, and he's really learning his craft at this point.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, it's not out of the ordinary for a director of note to do these telemovies as well, because obviously last time we were speaking about Craven's TV movies, so it's not like they're this is still early in his career, so you know, he's hardly like slumming it.
That's right and he's a lot of the stuff that you find, especially early on, it's the networking thing, isn't it? You start to kind of shape and pull. But that's one thing on that though, is that I found is that Carpenter just seemed to be meeting the right people at the right time when he's kind of organizing these things or coming up with these ideas. Because even like Halloween, it was a set of producers that approached him to with the idea of we want a horror film based around a stalker of babysitters.
So it's almost that wouldn't have happened without this film.
It does make you wonder, doesn't it, how these things kind of tied up. And obviously Assault on Precinct 13 has preceded this one, and it comes at a point where that film would have got a lot of people's attention. It was handled really well, shot really kind of precise. He would have done it within a good budget too. So it's all these kind of things that the producers or production companies will be taking note of.
And he's doing what you're supposed to do as a director. You're meant to gradually get better, and learn from your mistakes and keep pushing it. And
he does at this stage,
That's right. He's experimenting. He's still in an experimenting phase.
He is.
He hasn't quite got the confidence that he would gain after post-Halloween.
That's right. So let's get into the guts of the film itself. For those listeners that are new to this podcast, the idea is that we start kind of talking about the narrative of the plot line within the film. We kind of add our few comments along the way before we then kind of maybe mention a few nods to the players of the piece and then our final verdict. So we open up on this kind of city landscape. We're told it's LA. There's a recording device which is initiated, and we see someone dial out on their phone. There's a close-up of a telescope, and then we get a POV as it scales up and focuses on an apartment window and a woman within. There's a voice that tells her that he's been watching her. Elizabeth, who's the voice on the other end,
I've been watching you.
And so Elizabeth, the voice on the other end, says that she's leaving and he won't be able to find her. He disagrees, and then we get open credits.
Boom.
So we're already kind of into a bit of a sowing the seed of what's to come. I mean, she isn't the main person that we follow.
No.
But it gives you an indication of this person's been doing this on a regular basis.
Yeah, it's almost like the opener of an episode of CSI or something. You
You're
know?
Right. You're so right. Just,
you know, all it needs is David Caruso to take the sunglasses off.
yeah.
Looks like she regretted falling in love. But yeah, straight away, the opening credits. I mean, I'd be surprised if I was the only one who didn't think Hitchcock immediately.
Yeah. Oh, no, I totally Rear Window and stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Obviously, that's intentional. But I mean, obviously, no Carpenter synths this time.
No, right? Not in this instance. That's correct. Yeah. Well, and I guess the TV production company would have had rights or that. He wouldn't have had the freedom in that sense to play with that kind of stuff.
And you miss it. Like, you miss it. But it also doesn't, it's not that kind of a film as well. Like, it doesn't necessarily feel Carpenter-esque.
No, not at this stage, no.
No.
No. Or not even throughout the film, to be honest.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But it sets from the very first scene, you know, it's pretty
that's right.
It's obvious. Yeah, it's more Hitchcockian.
Yes. Oh, completely agree with that. We then continue with Lee, who's our lead protagonist, who is moving into this high-rise apartment. She's not exactly forthcoming with the truth about her character. And at first, my first impression of her was that she's a bit of a douche. Did you kind of get a similar vibe? That she's a bit too frosty.
I think you get the feeling that she's too good.
Yeah.
She's too good for everyone kind of thing.
Yeah, and I don't know. Like, if you're going for, like, first instincts and we're supposed to be rooting for her cause, that kind of turned me off a bit. I don't know.
Because she's a bit of a smart ass to the guy. But, yeah. I mean, I guess she just thinks that she's superior to him.
Yeah, I guess so.
We soon learn that she just likes to, you know, she's in her own head a lot, and she likes, she doesn't have an inner monologue.
No.
I wonder if that's out of necessity of, like, this character's going to be by themselves a lot. How am I going to, like, express the things that she's...
You hit the nail on the point on the head there, because, like, we do get into these series of where she just has these monologues. I guess that's a cheating the way of kind of letting the audience know her
that's
background,
right.
But it kind of, this point, it kind of really, you definitely feel that you're in TV movie territory.
Yeah, it feels like an excuse. It is. It's like, because it's all about visual storytelling, but in TV land, at this point of TV land, there was a clear separation between filmmaking and television and what you could get away with and what you had time to do. It's just,
that's right.
They're just, it's almost like, it's a get out of jail free card. It's like, if that character can express all the things that we want to do visually, then it will be much easier.
Absolutely. So yeah, so we follow Lee into the apartment. She moves in anyway into this apartment as she gets shown around. She walks onto the balcony, a little upset and clearly wanting a fresh start. Unbeknownst to her, she's being watched. So kind of throwing back to the opening scene that we saw. She gets into an elevator, practices a conversation with herself again, talking to herself. Gets in the car, drives off, and she's being followed as well. She gets shown around a television production studio and goes straight into the job without an interview as a live television director. That's kind of what she's there. So we kind of get this set up.
I did not get the feeling that that was a television network.
No,
like,
I didn't.
First.
I didn't.
Not until I think she was counting down. You know.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was intentional, but it was very. The set design really didn't scream out. This is a busy news.
I had the same reaction. I was like, oh, right, okay.
That's okay. Yeah. That's where they go.
All right.
I mean, she could have just been like it could have been a call center or something. You know?
Yeah.
There was like an office, and then there was a control room, and that was it.
That was kind of it.
Minimum. Neither of them looked particularly TV-ish.
No, they didn't. So, like, we also meet at this point a character called Sophie, played by Adrienne Barbeau. We've spoken about, well, not you and I, but Ant and I spoke about her previously in Swamp Thing. But it's important to note at this point, she would have an ongoing, career with John Carpenter. We would see her again in Escape from New York and The Fog.
Yep.
But this is where she would meet John Carpenter, and they'd go along and get married as well.
Well, then love. So,
They fall out of love. Yeah. So we meet her, and she's like, I guess she's kind of a bit of an assistant kind of character. And it's her that, it's Sophie that shows Lee around the office. We meet some kind of, we get some background on Lee when she's kind of indicates that she left her old place because of a guy. And we also learn at this point that Sophie's a gay character too.
Yeah, that was. That was refreshing to see.
Well, that I thought that too, because and is it that I'm looking at this? I don't know. I was just kind of surprised that that was a subject that was raised without any blink of an eye at that time that this movie was released.
Yeah, it's funny.
Like today, you would it's kind of accepted, you know.
Yeah,
it's
but
kind of
it isn't like not much has changed really. Like if
talk about Sulu from Star
Trek. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
like I think it's funny how like. Something like that, it shouldn't, the way it's treated is it's not a big deal, and it shouldn't be a big deal.
Yeah.
But even when it's not a big deal, people make it a big deal.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
If this film obviously came out before the days of, you know, online forums and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can imagine, like, there's always some kind of reaction to these things.
That's true, it's true. And I even, like, half thought, do I mention it in these notes, you know? But then,
yeah,
like, you can't not mention it, because there's a certain interplay that happens between Sophie and Lee, not in a physical kind of sense, but there is definitely kind of a knowing nod to each other, right? And a bit of friendly kind of banter, and which kind of borderlines I guess sexuality a little bit, maybe more coming from Sophie to Lee than the other way around. But yeah, I just, you know, it just struck me more so that was it was interesting the way it was handled.
Well, yeah,
within this particular scene.
This is like 76, 77.
It's 78 was when it came out. It came out just the year Halloween came out.
Yeah.
But literally earlier on in the year.
So you can imagine, you know, something like that on TV at that point in time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
that's it.
It's good to see.
I know. I agree. So then we kind of get later on in the day, Lee gets a strange phone call. She returns to her apartment to find that someone has broken in. She enters and she does the whole "I studied with Bruce Lee before he died," which massive clunky script line there.
What? I must have missed this line.
It's when she goes back into the apartment. She knows that somebody's broken in, so she starts to kind of do the whole. You know, you see it in movies, like, you know, go, "Ah, oh, the police! I've called the police!" La la la. But
yeah.
She doesn't say
that.
In this instance, she's like, I studied with Bruce Lee before he died. And like,
that's a bit of a clunker, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be anyone else around. She gets on the phone to building maintenance and we see someone dart across the room behind her. Again, this is something that Carpenter does use a lot, kind of like people in the background, movement in the background and stuff in his career. So the door shuts and she goes to investigate and she sees the lift door close. Doesn't really seem to think much of it. Later that night, we hear from the news that a woman had jumped to her death from a high-rise apartment. So it's kind of, I guess, alluding to the woman we saw in the first scene.
So was that a different complex entirely?
I think it was a different complex, yeah.
Right, because the idea, I mean, initially you're not really sure if it's he lives in one apartment across the way.
Yes.
Or whether we'll later find out he's an all-seeing...
Yeah, he's across it more than you think he is. Yeah, so... so then she gets Lee gets a telephone call from this guy called Steve, who's pestering her.
Steve,
who we presume is the ex that she was alluding to from before. She also gets several more calls. One where they hang up. The camera pans down to reveal that her desk has been bugged. Also, so someone is clearly listening. They call and they hang up. The next day, Lee returns to the apartment with Sophie. Lee gets a letter saying that she's won a competition. It details how she'll receive gifts over the coming weeks that indicate a holiday destination. She'll just need to guess where, and then she'll get the prize. That night, the lights flicker. Then Lee goes out into the town. She chats this guy up at the bar, and they go for a walk. We find out that he's a philosopher. They part ways, but just as she goes to leave, she runs back to give him her number, only to find that he's nowhere to be seen, and raising question marks about this strange guy that she meets. She gets into the car, and then this one probably big scare moment, I guess, is that this guy's head pops up.
Andre the Giant, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he just goes, "It's a hell of a life, isn't it?" And then walks off.
Truly, truly a David Lynch moment.
It was a bit weird, wasn't it?
Within a carpet film.
And we don't get any indication of this dude ever again, either. It's just
this
one incident where he pops up, which was a bit strange.
Only way it could have been weirder is if he was... walking along the sidewalk, but with holding a midget's hand. Like, the two of them just walked off into the night, and it was the same midget from Twin Peaks.
And a horse, a unicorn, and a giant.
Riding a unicorn.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That'll be it. All right, so the next day, Lee gets a phone call, and a person on the other end says, "Present number one." She sees a large parcel in a room and she opens it and finds a suitcase, and inside which is a telescope. When you, if you were to get an anonymous present, would you just go up and open it anyway? When you've just had these, like, weird... Are you kind of thinking, I'm going to go along for this because I might be in for winning a prize?
I guess in the 70s, maybe.
Maybe not. Get away with everything in the 70s.
Maybe not now.
Yeah, yeah.
Anthrax and things.
I know. Well, that was it. You know, who knows? Okay, so she gets another phone call telling her that the air conditioner isn't working. The next day, she goes and has a shower and the doorman leaves another gift. She opens it to find a bikini, and then the phone call again, and the guy says, present number two, I hope that it fits. Is this starting to get creepy?
Yeah.
A little bit?
Yeah, but I actually thought for a second, maybe she's, like, maybe they're trying to tell us that she, in a way, enjoys this in some sick, twisted way.
Yeah, yeah, maybe, maybe.
But unfortunately, I don't think that was the intention.
I mean, I guess it's going along the rules of, like, as well, that they've said it's a holiday destination, so if you were to win swimwear, then you kind of, and it's supposed to clue you to, oh, okay, so it's going to be a beach location.
Yeah. It just doesn't add up. The whole holiday, I never thought that she actually believed it. Like, how can
you
believe, like, those scams have been around for so long.
Hell yeah. So she gets, she then gets another phone call. First up, it's evening and she meets the guy. Guy happens to be Paul, who's the guy she met from the bar. She comes to the apartment, he comes to the apartment for dinner, and she confides in him about the gifts that she's been receiving, and then he leaves.
What are they eating in that scene?
I don't know.
It's
like, weird, wasn't it?
Like, it looks more like they've just got canapes there. Like, probably she's eating like an apple, like the slice
it
of
probably
an apple
was,
or whatever.
It's probably just what they got from the staff room cafeteria. And she's like, we need some food. Well, that'll do.
Yeah. I'm like, I wonder why he looks like, you know.
Disappointed.
Yeah.
Okay, so, he leaves, and then, like, so instantly there's like another phone call. So I guess, before I kind of allude to or announce what was said in the phone call, we're kind of maybe getting an indication that he could be the guy, because he's never around when the phone calls kind of happen.
Definitely. Yeah.
Right? And he just happens to crop up in her life. And the phone call just says, sweet dreams, Lee. The next scene, Paul pays Lee a visit at work, and he tells her that the company that's been sending her the gifts don't exist, at which point her phone rings, but she doesn't answer. And then Lee then goes out for a meal with Sophie. And it's then that when Sophie leaves Lee alone, Lee is given a complimentary drink from an unknown man at the bar. So again, indicating that somebody's been watching her. He's not there anymore, or he's gone. We go back to the apartment and there's another phone call. And the guy says, I'm sorry that you didn't enjoy the wine. Have you started to enjoy the view? At which point Lee starts to get panicky. She calls the police. They seem a bit dismissive, and Lee starts to kind of lose it a bit at this point. We cut to some time later and Lee's on the phone. She's been getting calls twice a day now and seems really tired and exhausted. She gets a parcel with photos of someone face down. And I wasn't sure who this was. Do you remember that?
No,
I thought it was a picture of the guy sending the photo, but I don't know if it was meant to be her, but no. I got a bit...
I mean, I think...
I just got lost.
We find out later on that yeah, like where the source of those, like where they came from. But
yeah,
I don't think it was immediately obvious.
No, I was just, yeah. I kind of went, oh, who was that? And it's not, I don't know, it just wasn't, yeah. I guess because their face is down, it's not really clear either. Anyway, so she gets this photo. She also gets a letter saying that this guy is going to wait for her in the garage. So she goes down to the garage to investigate. She has a knife with her, but she drops it down a grate.
Like a butter knife.
Yeah. spread some jam on you.
That's a slow, painful death.
she drops it down a grate and then climbs down inside it, at which point a guy comes by and stands on the grate over the top of her. And we don't really see his face, though it's because it's shot from her perspective. Mm-hmm. When she gets back to her apartment, there's a note left on her door which basically says, I'm sorry that we missed each other. Once again, Lee confides in Paul. She asks if he will stay with her tonight, and at which point we see that they're being watched as they start to get busy. So now we're kind of wondering, okay, maybe it isn't Paul, or it's not just one person, it's Paul and someone else.
Yeah.
Right? In the morning, Paul leaves. There's a phone call. It says, "I like you better without the robe. Take it off." And there's
that's it. That's
the moment where she's like, "I'm being watched. Shit. Oh my god!"
And he's just, you know, he's just toying with her now. It's just like, you know, I don't even care that you know that I'm watching. Nearby.
Yeah, that's it. So we get Sophie visiting her again, and she uses a telescope to spy on the neighbours. Paul is at the apartment too. Another letter is delivered, and it's, I noticed here that it says from DG Hill, removal. Now, Deborah Hill is the producer of Halloween.
Yeah.
D Hill, but I couldn't see anywhere that they knew each other when this was being made. It might just be a massive coincidence, but I was trying to see if there was like a...
But there is, they were quite close together though, right?
Yeah, it's hard to know what... I know. So I couldn't see anything, which, and nowhere I could see there was a forums or anything that mentioned it, but I kind of thought that struck me as, that must be about her. Anyway, we then meet the detective, and he talks with Paul and Lee about the recent events. We get another phone call. Now, though, she's starting to stand her ground, and she says, "I'm not far away, come look for me." Or is that what he says? Sorry. She's starting to stand her ground, and he says, "I'm not far away, come look for me." There's a guy in the apartment opposite who appears to be looking at her through the telescope. The police are called in and arrest the guy. They believe they've got their man, and Lee gets one more letter. Lee does start still feeling a bit paranoid, though, and feels though she's still being watched. She grabs a knife, goes to find the guy, despite Sophie's pleas not to. Sophie watches Lee from the telescope as she goes into the neighbor's apartment. So again, we get, this is really real window territory.
Yeah, definitely.
Where he goes,
it's blatant across. At this point. Yeah.
Oh yeah, very much so. She goes to investigate the penthouse in the apartment block across her. There's no sign of anyone there, but she finds the recording equipment, and there's a diary of all the entries and phone calls. So it's definitely the person's place that's been watching her. Sophie hears someone at the door at this point. So Sophie, just a reminder, is watching Lee in the apartment across. So Sophie hears someone at the door, and then she's attacked. Lee sees this through the telescope that's in the other building. She runs back to her own apartment, but there's no sign of Sophie. When she goes to tell the police about it, they believe that Sophie has booked a flight and left town. So just leading up to this, Sophie did indicate that she was leaving.
Yeah.
So it does align.
And obviously, our stalker would know this because he's had the place bugged. So
correct.
I'm guessing at some point he's heard the conversation about her plans to go elsewhere.
Yeah.
Because I was wondering what the point of... Obviously, it paid off eventually, but I was wondering what the point of that was.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so what?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so... So they don't believe basically that Sophie was attacked. So they just believe that she's skipped town. When the police leave, Lee finds the words written on her bathroom mirror saying, "No one believes you." I kind of wonder when that was done.
Yeah, I mean, because she hasn't really left, has she?
No.
She's come back and then she's...
So he would have had to have done it after killing Sophie, gotten rid of the body, and written on the...
But she, yeah, at that point, she wasn't, you know, she hadn't gone out and said that, "Look, you still haven't found the guy," kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. Anyway, look, it's probably a minor point, but it was a quibble of mine. So at this point, there's another phone call, and the person on the other end says, "You left the shower on, Lee." Lee collapses on the floor, knocking the table over, and then this is where she discovers that her room's been bugged under the table. Lee then drives off, and the guy calls her on the walkie-talkie. I'm not quite sure how that works, and then plays Sophie's death over it.
Yeah, which is
to antagonize more.
Yeah, so obviously the walkie-talkie has been on
all
the time.
Yeah,
and the batteries are
good stuff.
Yeah, energizers.
That's it.
Not ever readies.
They're not ever readies, that's right.
Sponsored by Energizer.
So Lee then confides in Paul again. They begin to suspect that it could be a maintenance engineer of the building. So Paul goes off to investigate while Lee goes to some person called Stiles' house. I start getting a bit lost here. I don't know about you. She finds a pamphlet on surveillance equipment. So then she goes back to her apartment, and she feels that someone has been there. Somehow she gets locked inside and the power fuses out. She then discovers a suicide note apparently written by her. She calls out to the attacker and then smashes a window to call for help. Her attacker then comes out and forcibly tries to throw her from the window. Somehow she grabs a shard of glass and plunges it into the back before he then throws himself out of it. And she says, "Got too close," as we zoom in on Lee's face, close credits.
Freeze frame.
Freeze frame, freeze frame.
Yeah.
Another bit of a Hitchcock nod there too. Dial in for murder. There's a scene where there's a struggle with the telephone because he goes to try and strangle her. She ends up getting some scissors and shoving him in the back.
Yeah.
With them. With the
I'm sure there's a lot more of those as well.
There probably is.
Peppered throughout. I actually think, like, going back to the opening credits, I'm pretty sure that North by Northwest has a similar. I mean, in this film, it's the shot from like the footpath looking up at the building, the grid pattern of the, and it's animated and then it slowly goes into live action again.
Yes.
But the whole North by Northwest opening credits is different city shots of a city street, and it follows that almost exact same
absolutely
method. So it's, you know, it's like his chance to pay homage to one of his like favorite filmmakers.
Yeah, that's right. And interesting, I don't know if I should be saying this, but interesting that recently in the news that Luc Besson's just been found guilty of plagiarism of Escape from New York, when Carpenter's whole career has been lifted off other, or inspired by other movies.
Well,
there's a lot of, where does it, I find it hard to know where you can find originality in movies these days, where, you know, it's kind of like how what makes it. I mean, there's a lot of, obviously, what am I trying to say, there's a lot of areas within the film in question, Lockout, that is very similar to Escape from New York.
Yeah,
but there's differences there too, surely, like, enough to,
maybe this is why studios just insist on doing remakes of things rather than doing an original idea inspired by something.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, Tarantino is pretty fucked then, isn't it? Because it's just, it's like, there's entire chunks of Kill Bill that are like straight rips.
Oh, yeah.
Kung Fu films.
Absolutely.
But it's because there's like 100 different ones within the one movie.
I guess so, but also, I guess the difference there is, I mean, you have to then look at plot line and dialogue is essentially what would make it original. So it's more
of a carbon copy. Like the framework is the thing that's very similar.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've got structurally you've got a different story and you just pepper it with little rips. Well, sometimes complete rips of scenes. But when you go word for word dialogue, it's a bit.
Yeah. I agree. So we come to the end of the film. What was your gut reaction to it? I mean, obviously we're not looking at the high end of his movies, and
no,
we are in TV movie territory. But what was your?
Yeah, I don't think it says nothing new happens at all in the film.
No,
like there's no point. You know where the plot's going. They want it to be like a whodunit, but I think, I don't know, I picked early on who it was. Like, I had a fair idea that it was, like, the doorman.
Mm.
Or the, you know, just because, yeah, I think it makes it obvious for you.
Yeah.
And that's probably a TV thing.
Well, particularly then, too. Like, it's like, how do you,
those procedurals. And
And you also know that with the TV movie, you've only got a handful of cast.
That's it. I mean, there's really only, what, so there's three, well, two and a half kind of, like people that it could be, like realistic could be, and one of them is Jerry Seinfeld's uncle, so it's like,
I wrote that,
probably not him. Paul's hair is just too nice,
too coy,
his turtleneck jumpers as well,
he's got too much, you can never suspect somebody in a turtleneck, come on. All right, so let's look at the characters of the piece. So there's only a few people to kind of mention. The lead, Lee Michaels, was played by Lauren Hutton. She would play Aggie Maybank in 76's Gator alongside Burt Reynolds. According to IMDb, she was in Fred Shepsie's The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith.
Oh, what role did she play?
I don't know. It just kind of had her there as, it was something like woman. or you know, it wasn't like
I'm trying to remember now.
I might IMDb it while we're recording and fudge it just to make it sound like I know what I'm talking about. But apparently, yeah, in there she was in. She was listed in the credits. It's quite a way down. She was also make an appearance in films like American Gigolo, The Countess. She played the role of the Countess in 1985's Once Bitten. She was in My Father the Hero, and she was also in 54. So she's had kind of bit roles. That's right. Mike Myers, 54, that's the one. So she had kind of like bit parts, you know, dotted around the place, but never really as kind of materialized. She was a model beforehand, and that's kind of what caught John Carpenter's eye a bit.
Yeah, I bet it did. John.
When he cast her. I could lead this. My reaction to her was that I found her quite hammy and over the top, and particularly early on. I didn't warm to her character. However, I did read stuff about her after the fact that, you know, there's things about that, you know, when she was she was, as I said, hired from a modeling background. But the shot at the end where she's having that struggle with the attacker.
Yeah.
Where they smash the window and they're kind of leaning out. Yeah. So they shot that from the roof, pointing down.
Yeah.
And it's a real shot. So she's actually the one throwing herself out over the edge.
But did they not do it on a soundstage with the green screen?
No, they didn't. They actually didn't.
So
it kind of makes me go, well, all right, I'll give her credit there for putting herself into the role. It sounds really risky to have done something like that.
I'm actually, I'm impressed by that.
Yeah. I was too. I was like, oh, really?
So is that a budgetary reason? They're like, fuck it, this is...
I've no idea.
We can't afford a green screen.
I don't know. It does make you question, doesn't it? Anyway, so, that was my one kind of thought about her. I didn't really warm to the character. I didn't really connect with her on any sense, but, yeah, so I mean, I don't know. What did you? How did you find her?
I fell in and out of love with her. I mean, I think her grudge, just her mannerisms when she was meant to be showing like discomfort and being creeped out, it came off as comical at times.
Yeah,
she pulled some weird faces like she'd just let off a fart. I don't think she quite externalized. The emotions that she was meant to be having. Like, I can just almost hear Carpenter just off camera. It's just like, all right, now you're freaked out. You're freaked out. More freaked out. Maybe not that freaked out.
Let's dial it back a bit.
Yeah.
I love it.
But that comes with experience, I guess.
Yeah.
So this is still early on in her.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. This was her first movie, I think.
Yeah, there were some interesting lines that she had. I think when she first takes the place, she says something like, "I'll take it." And it's like, it'll be like living in the top drawer of a glass box or something like that. It's like, just some strange...
There are some strange lines. Yeah, some strange lines in it, I have to admit. Anyway, look, it is what it is.
But she is attractive, so that's, you know...
Yeah.
I'm sure that the studio heads were...
Do you know what? Weirdly, like, the video cover, she doesn't look anything like that. I don't know if you had a look
at it. Yeah, no, I had to make sure...
Because as I was watching it, I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Is that her? Because it doesn't look like...
Just got one of those faces that can change according to... Yeah.
Lighting. Like Seinfeld as well. Remember that with the...
It comes back to Seinfeld.
Yeah, it does. Okay, so the lead, male lead, I guess, is Paul. He's played by a guy called Dave Burney. He was known in the TV circles. The studios insisted on casting a known TV celebrity, and that was their pick. One of the roles he was in was Serpico, the TV series, playing Serpico. I didn't even know there was a Serpico TV series.
Neither did I.
Which makes me want to check it out. I always nod these kind of little things like Tales of the Unexpected. He was in an episode of that. I'm a Brit, so kind of was a huge fan of Tales of the Unexpected. He was in an episode called The Nomads.
Is that Twilight Zone-ish?
Kind of. It was Roald Dahl wrote them, so it was kind of like based on a novel. So it was a series of them. They were like one off. Yeah, they'd be leaning into the dark age. Some were better than others, obviously. I don't recall which one that was in particular, but
was he wearing a turtleneck?
I only hope he was. Most most people would who may recognize his face and are fans of daytime TV might know him as Dr. Ben Samuels in St. Elsewhere, which he was a regular of.
Funny though, like, even though he would be considered quite an attractive guy, teeth aren't great.
Teeth weren't a focus then. You noticed that when you start looking at looking back at these things, like,
yeah.
So he's there, I guess, as a bit of a red herring kind of character. He's there to be the smooth, charming man.
And there are moments when he's like, I think when he takes the letter, like, can I just, I want to take this.
Yeah.
He'll often look like he's in deep thought.
Yes.
And that's like him trying to throw the audience off and, you know.
That's right.
Make us think he could be part of this whole conspiracy.
Indeed. So just rounding out the other core kind of characters, we've got, as we said, Adrienne Barbeau. It's the first time she would work alongside John Carpenter. I already mentioned she was in The Fog and Escape from New York. She also, just to repeat some of her credits, would be in Creepshow, would appear as Ruthie in Carnivale, played Susanna Coffrey in Dexter, Sons of Anarchy she cropped up in too. More recently was in Tales of Halloween. She's apparently meant to be playing the role of the narrator too in the forthcoming Death House, which is the, I guess, horror's answer to The Expendables, you know, Sylvester Stallone all action. So there's a movie that's coming out with all the horror guys coming.
Yeah, and girls.
And girls, yeah, because what's the name? Dee Wallace is going to be in it.
Nice.
Two. So that's something not there. I'm not sure. It's not like one of her most noted roles, this one with Adrienne. Like, she is there to support the title, the lead character of Lee.
She gets to show a bit of sass though.
She does get to show a bit of sass, which is an indicator of things to come when working in a lot of, well, particularly like the role of Stevie in The Fog.
Yeah.
So you get a kind of early indication of things like that. And then the last person to mention, people to mention, there's Len Lesser, who plays the burly man, always known as Uncle Leo in Seinfeld. And also another John Carpenter regular, Charles Cyphers, who plays the detective in this. And we've seen him in Assault on Precinct 13.
I couldn't. I'm just trying to pick it. And I'm like, I'm not going to cheat. I'm not going to look it up on IMDb.
That's who he is. And we see him as, detective in the sheriff, in Halloween.
I was going to say he's the character. He's the typecast.
Yeah, always plays the detective character.
Was he in like a Spielberg? I feel like he's played.
He was in The Fog as well, and Escape from New York, which we'll talk about down the track.
I feel like I've seen him.
Here in a Spielberg film, but that may have been just that I've missed it.
I'm just picturing him as a small town sheriff.
That's it.
Every movie ever made,
pretty much. Okay, so look, apparently, let's talk about the director's notes. We've only got about 5 minutes to kind of wrap this up, but apparently, this was based on a true story. They just changed the stalker to be a maintenance guy to explain how he was able to get access to everywhere. There's some notes there from, like, Carpenter said that everybody's a voyeur in a sense, so it's kind of like a nod to the fact that we're being a voyeur watching a voyeur, which has been done a lot of times better, right? Like Peeping Tom is an example of one that's done it really well.
And I think that's why that's another problem, because why do something unless you're going to add to it or improve
on
it?
Yeah.
And it doesn't do anything new.
Exactly, yeah. I kind of mentioned this. Carpenter was hired by the production team to write the story, but it was considered too soft. And so it was turned into a television movie, which is interesting. John Carpenter's agent, made sure that he was attached as director when they kind of got the rights made into it. So that's how he got it done. It was shot under 10 days, as you mentioned, heavily inspired by Hitchcock techniques throughout. So this was the first time John Carpenter wouldn't be a composer in the movies he's done. He said he found that process really interesting.
And since?
I think. Yeah, he's pretty much been hands-on ever since then. I think he didn't say as much, but he kind of indicated that he found it a bit difficult to be that hands-off with the music side of things. He said he learned the basics in making this movie. This is where he learned how to pace yourself and the bread and butter, of how to put something together. This is where he learned.
He had to shoot quite quickly, so
that's right. He said there's a lot of the framing and the flow from this movie he would repeat in Halloween. And yeah, essentially it was a learning curve for him, you know, although it did obviously have its limitations from being a TV movie.
But lucky for him, you know, he gets to practice and
have that. Yeah,
that be this thing that people aren't necessarily going to look back at your canon, like official canon, and
yeah,
count that as like
no, that's right, that's, you know, right,
something to judge you by.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, there was another TV movie he made, like with Elvis, you know, the TV movie, which we aren't using as part of this canon.
Mm.
You know,
genre-wise,
it doesn't fit. I mean, yeah. I know that we've talked more science fiction kind of territory and dystopian kind of stuff, which isn't necessarily horror. But the other movies we're talking about within this early season are all the right kind of stepping stones to what would lead on to his horror journey.
Yeah. In fact, I think Elvis sits outside of most of his body of work.
Yeah, it does, really. Yeah.
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 Which isn't to say it's not a good...
No, it's actually good TV movie, to be honest. But yeah, anyway, that's aside. Final verdict on this one. So we're three movies into this.
This is probably... Well, excluding his later films, like, you know, post 1990,
yeah,
I think this is probably his weakest,
yeah,
of that run.
Yeah,
that
I agree.
But I mean, it's pretty hard when the run is so great.
Well, from here on in, like, it's a massive run of successful,
yeah,
movies, and we are only going to get the chance to talk about three of those off the bat, being,
yeah,
Halloween, The Fog, and Escape from New York. But yeah, like, you know, we'll get into the nitty gritty of that. But you're right. And I guess this purely, the reason I enter this one in our conversations is that it's the learning curve. And yes, he says he learned a lot of the stuff that he would then reciprocate or repeat in,
yeah,
Halloween. So it's an important one to keep in there. I think that kind of pretty much rounds it up, unless you've got something else to add to this one there, Ben.
I would probably mention here, and I'm ashamed to say this, I got a little bored about halfway through this film, so I started watching it at like 1.5 speed so I could get through it a bit quicker. So I actually would say, if you are gonna revisit this film, that's probably my recommendation
to watch it.
I don't think you lose too much, and you can put the subtitles on, and
that's,
you know,
true. I think this movie, I think, just to echo that too, this movie you could probably get away with not putting on your to-do list of movies of Carpenter's to watch.
Well, maybe watch it double time.
Watch it double time.
Double time, even.
You know, and then
just
kind of cast your thoughts at the end.
Just as long as you're cool with the characters all sounding like chipmunks, then you know.
Yeah. Wait, what was that? Was that integral to the plot? No. Okay, well, look, that concludes our third horror film surgery for the season. Stick around for the next session, which is going to be the horror classic Halloween. We hope you enjoyed our discussions. Until next time, we are Ben Skinner and me, your humble host, Paul Farrell. Ben's already checked out. Okay, that's it. Goodbye.
You're listening to the Surgeons of Horror podcast.
John Carpenter.
The early years. Someone's watching me. Music supplied by Peter Nezick. For more discussions or podcasts, head over to surgeonsofhorror.com or head over to our Facebook and Twitter sites for the latest news and updates.